What does it take to develop a vaccine against COVID-19? How should we think about individual human immunity against this disease before thinking of ideas like herd immunity? Here on the Pragati podcast, I'm delighted to rebroadcast episode 8 of the BIC Talks podcast with award-winning medical scientist Dr. Gagandeep Kang. BIC Talks is a twice-a-week podcast by the Bangalore International Center, where I work as a consultant and host some of their episodes, including this one. Go to their website, bangaloreinternationalcenter.org, or search for BIC Talks on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to BIC Talks today. Welcome to the Pragati Podcast, a weekly talk show on public policy, economics, and international relations. We take a step back from noisy political debates and dive into rich conversations on India and the world. I am your host, Pavan Srinath. We'll start this episode's conversation after a short break. Professor Gagandeep Kang is the Executive Director of the Translational Health Science and Technology Institute. She's an award-winning medical scientist who has worked extensively on diarrheal diseases, virology, and vaccine development. Dr. Kang, welcome to BIC Talks.
Thank you for having me.
This is the sixth conversation that we are having around various aspects of COVID-19 on BIC Talk. And today I want to explore two broad themes with you. One, the idea of vaccine development and the idea of immunity, and also the associated big unknowns in our science and knowledge that researchers will be trying to answer over the coming weeks, months, and perhaps years. So I wanted to start with vaccines. You played a key role in the development of Rotavac, a vaccine that can prevent a large number of severe diarrhea infections in India and the world. So before we get to COVID-19, could you tell us about how conventional vaccines have been developed and how these vaccines work?
So if we look at vaccines are actually trying to harness the power of the human immune system. There are a lot of bacteria, viruses, parasites out there, and we get infected with those quite frequently. Our body learns to handle them. We respond to that infection. And frequently, we are protected for some time, a short or a long time after that infection. When we want to make a vaccine, essentially, we are trying to recapitulate what happens in natural infection, but do that in a very controlled fashion by having components of the infectious organism or the whole infectious organism given to people at a predictable time and with a predictable dose to induce an immune response that protects but does not result in any disease. We've known how to make vaccines for over 200 years now, starting with the smallpox vaccine. But the technologies that we have available for making vaccines now are just phenomenal. Earlier, we used to make all vaccines by taking the whole organism and either inactivating it or taking a component of that organism or weakening a living organism and give that to people as vaccines. Until about the 1980s, that's how pretty much every vaccine was made. Since then, we've come up with a lot of new technologies that are used to make vaccines. The first important one was our ability to induce an immune response to polysaccharides, which are usually not good inducers of a long protective immune response. But we learned how to tie these sugar molecules that are responsible for the virulence of certain kinds of organisms. We linked them to proteins, and that made it possible for our body to react to them and make long protective immune responses. That was the first time we learned how to do better than nature. And now we have a lot of other methods where we are trying to do the same thing, making vaccines directly from sequence data, making RNA vaccines, making DNA vaccines, which essentially recruit the body to become a factory that makes the proteins to which the immune system responds. This is a very exciting time to be thinking about and working in vaccines. And with COVID-19, we actually have a situation where almost every technology that is available for making vaccines is currently being applied.
Thanks, Dr. Kang. Is this why with older vaccines, when we got the vaccine, we'd feel ill for a few days and then we'd recover, and that would be an integral part of being vaccinated? But with modern vaccines, you might not even see such a reaction in the body?
Actually, what the feeling ill for a few days is called the reactogenicity of a vaccine. So how much additional symptoms does it produce? The redness at the site of injection, the fever. That tends to happen with the older bacterial vaccines. It doesn't happen as often with the viral vaccines. And that's because many of the components in the old bacterial vaccines contain things that cause inflammation. New vaccines are designed to be somewhat less reactogenic. And in the studies that are done for vaccine development, tracking these side effects is considered very important, and a very reactogenic vaccine might not be used today.
Thanks, Dr. Kang. Before we dive into COVID-19 and the, I think, 90 plus projects that are ongoing, as you mentioned in a previous webinar, could you tell us about your journey on Rotavac and the attempts at developing a vaccine for rotavirus? Because in popular discussion, we like to be quite triumphalist in our achievements in science, right? Because we think that somebody had a brainstorm and a great idea, and then it became this wonderful thing. But scientific research involves going down a lot of blind alleys, dead ends, and forks and other things before arriving at meaningful answers and solutions.
So if you look at the rotavirus vaccines, the virus was discovered as being a human pathogen in 1973, and efforts to make a rotavirus vaccine started when the virus could be cultured in the early 1980s and have continued since then. Globally, the first licensed rotavirus vaccine was licensed in 1998, and that was based on what is called the Jennerian principle, where you take an animal virus, put it into humans, it doesn't replicate very well, but it induces an immune response. So the first vaccine that was made was a mix of monkey viruses and human viruses. It was a reactogenic vaccine, caused a lot of fever in children, and it was licensed in the US in 1998. The process of developing that vaccine was a long one, but after the vaccine got licensed, about a year and a half later, cases of intussusception, which is telescoping of one part of the gut into another, were noted, and the vaccination program was stopped. The vaccine was withdrawn, and it was found that there was an association of intussusception with the rotavirus vaccine. So at that time, globally, people began to think whether it was ever going to be feasible to make a rotavirus vaccine or not. Subsequently, two multinational companies did take it up, arguing that the lives you saved from diarrhea were much greater than any that you might lose because of a risk of intussusception. So while this was happening in the global arena, there was also a scientist at All India Institute of Medical Sciences and one at the Indian Institute of Science. At AIIMS, it was Dr. M.K. Bhan, and in the Indian Institute of Science, it was Dr. Durga Rao. Both of them discovered at AIIMS in the 1980s and at IISc in the 1990s that there were neonatal rotavirus infections that were caused by particular strains of rotavirus. The Delhi strain was called 116E and the IISC strain was called I321. These began to be developed as vaccine candidates under a program of the Department of Biotechnology called the Indo-US Vaccine Action Program that had been established around 1987. Both of these were progressed as vaccine candidates, and when they were characterized, it was found that although these strains had been derived from human neonates, children who were admitted in neonatal nurseries, these were actually reassorted strains. They had genes that came from cows and from humans. The Delhi strain was mostly human and the Bangalore strain was mostly bovine.
So what we think of as one virus was not one virus. It was many different strains at the same time.
Yes. This happens for influenza viruses and rotaviruses very easily. They have a segmented genome, which means their nuclear material is carried on multiple genes. Influenza has 8 and rotavirus has 11. So if you get a mixed infection, if a person is infected or a cow is infected with a human virus, a person is infected with a cow virus, you can get reassortment. So the progeny viruses that are made can have genes that are derived from both parent viruses.
What we are seeing is perhaps a back to human transition, and all the unknowns that we have right now with COVID-19, this is far from the first such instance. The idea of viruses going back and forth between humans and sort of animals which are around humans has been happening even before and has been well studied and documented.
Absolutely. So when you interact with any animal species, they have their own set of viruses. We have our own set of viruses. But while viruses tend to be reasonably host restricted, which means they stay in the species that they are adapted to, it can happen that you will have mutations in the viruses that will allow them to transition from one species to another. This is something that happens very frequently in influenza. And as I just explained, in rotavirus, you may either have an entire animal virus coming across into humans, or you might have genes of the animal virus coming into human viruses and then continuing to replicate in human. This is not at all an uncommon phenomenon.
From this discovery of these new strains, what did it take for us to actually get to a rotavac which could be deployed in the field and be given to patients, to children as vaccines?
So initially you have the studies that characterize the viruses. That's how we found out that these were reassortant viruses. And then you have to do preclinical studies and then get into humans. The preclinical studies are very rarely relevant for vaccines because you need a really good model for the studies to be valuable in product development. With the rotavirus vaccines, there is an interesting story about how the animal studies led us down the wrong path. Rotaviruses are viruses where there is a classification that is based on two proteins of the virus, which are called the G and P proteins. There are different types and they circulate in different parts of the world, and they change with season. Rather like the influenza viruses, where we are all familiar with H1N1, H3N2, etc., being the viruses that circulate in humans. In rotaviruses, these are the G and P types, G1, P8, G2, P4. Now, when these viruses were studied in animals, it was found that there was very little cross-reactivity between the G and P types. So it was believed that it was very important that, like influenza vaccines, you needed to be able to tailor the strains that were in the vaccine to the ones that were circulating in humans. So you had to make a mixture of viruses that could address the strains that were in a particular geography. Now, this was done, And some people decided to take a different approach, saying that if we make a vaccine that is based entirely on a human strain, and it is a single strain vaccine, we think that it will be enough to protect against other types. So both these types of vaccines were made. And what we found was that humans reacted very differently from mice, whereas in mice, you needed multiple viruses to protect against multiple viruses in the vaccine to protect against all those types of viruses. In humans, it was sufficient to be given a vaccine with only one type of virus in it, and you were protected against multiple types of viruses that were out there. So the difference between what was seen as heterotypic immunity being a requirement in animals didn't really hold up in the case of rotaviruses in humans. And this is important because this distinguishes them from many other RNA viruses like influenza, where we know that you need to have specific types of viruses in there. You need to match the strains with the circulating viruses in the community. So doing animal studies is important, but it's not sufficient. When you move into humans, you go through phase one, phase two, phase three studies. Phase one studies are usually done in a very small number of participants. These are safety studies and are intended to see whether the virus is, the preparation is reactogenic or not. In phase two studies, you measure immunogenicity. Does the virus induce an immune response? And in phase three studies, you check to see whether the virus is safe, immunogenic, but also effective in preventing the disease that it is targeted. Phase one studies usually have a small number, about 20 participants. In phase two, you might go up to about 5 to 10 times that number. In phase three, a lot depends on how common the disease is, but you might need anywhere from 2,000 to 100,000 people to be involved in a phase three study. If all three phases are successful, then the manufacturer who makes the vaccine submits an application for licensure to the regulatory authorities in the country. And if approved, it becomes a licensed vaccine that can then be marketed and sold in that country.
This process seems so involved, so complex, and we've seen the length of time it has taken for a variety of viral and bacterial diseases in the past. So now coming to COVID-19, where everything we want to do in mission mode, much faster to be able to react to a global pandemic, as opposed to many which have been large diseases that's been prevalent for a long time. What all do you see that are different? In a recent webinar with the India Alliance, you spoke about how there are 90 plus ongoing projects to develop vaccines. And the first two vaccine candidates, I think by Moderna and CanSino, if I'm not mistaken, have already entered human clinical trials and more will be going into trials shortly. Right. So first, is this unprecedented, the scale and the speed of these efforts that are happening right now compared to your own and other efforts in the past?
Absolutely. This is a remarkable time. And the work that scientists around the world have put into looking at drugs and looking at developing vaccines is just unprecedented. In fact, from the India Alliance seminar to now, we have more candidates that have gone into vaccine trials. At the time, it was an RNA vaccine and a vaccine that was based on a protein, which was in an adenovector. Now we also have a DNA vaccine as well as protein vaccines that have entered human trials. There are also very interesting vaccines that are coming out of an institute in China that focuses on the immune response, that are using antigen-presenting cells as a potential way of vaccination. So there are at least 4 different classes of products in 6 clinical studies now.
So apart from a real global interest in the urgency for solving this pandemic, pandemic crisis. What do you think are the new technologies that are in play that are making this possible? Like, would a messenger RNA-based vaccine, would that even be possible a while ago? Could you explain that a little more to us? Because we understand from the cowpox and the smallpox era to beyond how the idea of a Tika works very broadly. But we have no idea how some of these new methods work. And you explained initially how some of them use the human body as a factory. But could you perhaps give us a little more of a picture of how they work?
So if we look at the interaction of the immune system, basically so far all the successful vaccines that we have rely on an antibody response. And an antibody is something that your body makes in response to a component of the infectious agent, which is called an antigen. There is an interest also in looking at cell-mediated immunity and how that might be important for certain kinds of pathogens, but we won't go into that at the moment. If we look at mRNA technology, what you're essentially doing is getting RNA into the cell. How a virus usually works is the virus gets inside the cell. And in the case of COVID-19, we have an RNA virus. Its genome is made up of RNA. What it does is it hijacks the cell's machinery and gets the cell to make copies of the virus. And it does that by having its RNA genome read by the cell's machinery and giving instructions to the cell to now make the proteins that it requires to make copies of itself. When we think about mRNA vaccines, what we are doing is not taking all of the genes of the virus and asking the cell to make all of the proteins of the virus, but asking the cell to make only the proteins that we think are going to be good antigens. Once these antigens, the message on messenger RNA is delivered into the cell is told, make copies of this protein, the cell does that. Those are then released and become antigens that the immune system can then recognize. So what the mRNA vaccine is doing is using the cell as a factory for making specific types of proteins, not the whole virus.
So the virus is trying to hijack and use our cells as its own factory. And here you have a vaccine which is trying to do something to counter the viral effects. This is amazing for us to sort of hear and understand how things happen within the human body. I also want to ask, is it important to have 90 or 100 different efforts happening in parallel? Is that the scale that is necessary for even one or two ideas to actually come to market or come to actual use?
So if you look at the classes in which vaccines are being made, there are about 10 different kinds of approaches that people are taking. And within those, some are more popular than others. So there are 8 mRNA vaccines being made. The number of DNA vaccines being made is fewer. There are a lot of vectored vaccines. We recently had the Ebola vaccine licensed. That uses a vesicular stomatitis virus vector as the backbone which carries antigens into the body. So we have many kinds of vectors, adenovectors, VSV vectors, measles being used as a vector for bringing proteins in. Which of these will be successful? We have absolutely no idea. It's very important to remember there are no currently licensed RNA vaccines. There are no currently licensed DNA vaccines. There is one vectored vaccine that is licensed. There are several protein vaccines that are licensed. But protein vaccines frequently require adjuvants, and those adjuvants or immune potentiators are also in limited supply around the world. So having 90 candidates is essential for us to have multiple shots on goal so that at least 1, 2, or 3 of those go in. I doubt that we are going to have 15 new vaccines next year.
that is a much needed reality check and also gives us hope. These are shots on goal. There are multiple places at which the stops can fall short. So the general conversation that a lot of people are having is that, you know, we might need 18 months to get a vaccine introduced and, you know, being produced at scale. Is this 18 months like a minimum period that you envisage, or is it possible that all the efforts might still end up failing at some point and we might have to imagine a world where we don't have a vaccine in 18 months or 24?
It is possible that we won't have a vaccine in 18 months. All of these efforts might fail. We hope that they don't. We have some indications that an immune response is feasible. And with the kinds of efforts that are being put in, I think that with our ingenuity now, we will come up with a successful product. Now, the problem that many people are worried about is whether the vaccine might induce an effect that would lead not to protection, but to enhancement of disease. And there are a couple of ways that this can happen. And if that does turn out to be the case, if this vaccine behaves like dengue, or this vaccine has an effect on macrophages, which are the two ways that it might play out, then making certain kinds of vaccines would be very difficult. You could not, for example, then go in with an inactivated virus. You would need to choose the proteins that you selected as antigens very carefully. But given that we have so many different approaches and so much study of immune responses going on, I'm hopeful that we will have a vaccine next year. The problem really is going to be the scalability of manufacture and the realities of who can get vaccine when it's not a vaccine that is made in your country. So if we were to have a vaccine that was made in Australia or the US, what would be the incentive that would persuade them to supply it to us, for example?
There is a sovereign question also that comes up, right? So any sense of how India should be thinking of this in the medium term on how we can have vaccine access of our own? Is there enough of this that's also happening in an open source manner where once something is developed, there is already an agreement in place for it to be shared freely so long as locally it can be manufactured, for example?
So right now, we are in such an early stage that it's hard to know which programs are going to progress or not. So should you build a factory for an RNA vaccine? Is it the same as a factory for a protein vaccine? If you had to make a vectored vaccine, what kind of facility would you require? These are things to which we need to find answers quickly. And if you want to make vaccine at scale, you need to be thinking about making investments now, and these would need to be at-risk investments, knowing that the product that you are betting on might fail, and the facility that you're building for manufacturing or repurposing for manufacturing might not be used for that purpose. But if you think about it, if you really want a vaccine next year and you want it to be delivered to your population, you have to be part of the global conversation around vaccines while also supporting your own efforts to develop vaccines.
I'm guessing that what, say, the Gates Foundation is trying to do with investment in a few factory units are all along similar lines, right? The idea is to deploy risk capital in the eventuality that this is type of vaccine that works and has to be scaled up very quickly.
That is correct. And there are companies in India that are responsible for making billions of doses of vaccine, which is supplied to global markets. So in terms of looking at global vaccine security, I think our companies would be places should be in the conversation around how we make vaccines, not just for ourselves, but for the world. Many of our vaccine companies are working on candidates of their own. But in addition to that, we should be thinking about what facilities they might have that could be used for a more global agenda.
Thanks, Dr. Kang. I want to shift our conversation a little to a broader question on immunity, especially a conversation on immunity before a vaccine comes into the picture, right? So because currently there are a lot of conversations happening on herd immunity as a national policy in certain countries and so on. So my first question there is, what do we know so far about human individual immunity towards COVID-19 and the SARS-CoV-2 virus? Is someone who recovers from an infection immune to reinfection?
When you are infected, usually after any infection that is induced by proteins, in this case by viral proteins, you make an immune response that protects. The question is it short-term protection or long-term protection? And what is the mechanism of that protection? For viruses, the mechanism is most likely neutralization of the virus, demonstrating that it is unable to get inside cells and replicate. For SARS-CoV-2, we measure immune responses. We can measure immune responses to different components of the virus. And many of the rapid tests that have become available claim to or do actually measure immune responses to viral components. These are usually on the surface of the virus. But if you want to know whether the immune response is functional, you need to do a neutralization test. These are complicated to do and require you to have the live virus or a pseudovirus, but these can be done. In what we've seen from looking at patients who have been infected with SARS-CoV-2, it appears that there are some patients that do not make a very strong immune response even when they have been confirmed to be infected. Now, what that means in terms of their ability to be protected for a while, what level of antibody will protect you and for how long are all currently unknown. But these are being explored wherever there are patient cohorts.
Thank you for highlighting that they are still at least unknowns and they are still things that we are trying to get more information on. So what you mentioned about some of these immune responses that are captured or used in rapid diagnostic tests. I mean, I've heard you and others mention two particular things, IgG, immunoglobulin G, and IgM, where I think IgM is an immunoglobulin response that comes more quickly and IgG is something that comes a little later but stays for much longer. And as someone who's been infected with dengue twice, I have seen this a similar IgG and IgM response in some of my tests for dengue as well. So here, currently, do we have reliable tests for this individual immunity, however partial that immunity might be? Or are they currently only good enough for sort of a quick analysis of how things are in a large community?
So right now, I don't think that the tests are measuring any level of protection or immunity. What they are measuring is some level of exposure. And even with exposure, the problem really is that when you have a low level of infection in a community, then the chances of your positive test being a false positive are quite high. This is counterintuitive, but basically, if you have 100 people in a population and you say a test is 99% specific and 99% sensitive, if your 100 people are all infected, your 99% sensitivity tells you that you've detected infection in 99 and missed one. If you have 100 uninfected people and you have 99% specificity, then one person will falsely be labeled as being positive when they are not. So when you have a community that is largely uninfected, then the accuracy of a test that tests positive tends to be quite low. There's a high chance that it might be a false positive. So these are not tests that you should rely on at the individual level at this time. It's okay for population screening, for looking at whether a population has high or low levels of exposure, because a few percent doesn't matter as much there. But to make an individual level diagnosis, we need better tests.
If I'm not mistaken, the current ICMR testing protocol uses some of the science well, so that the rapid tests are deployed in sort of clusters and in areas so that you can study how perhaps the viral load is in that particular hotspot or a cluster. Am I right in saying so? So
in terms of assessing, as I mentioned, it's really a question of looking at, is this population exposed or not? And in hotspots, you would anticipate higher levels of exposure.
Right. So the tests would make more sense in those populations with higher exposure levels, as opposed to the entire country, which might still have an exposure level of 1 or 2%.
Yes, but even more valuable than a single time point test in a hotspot is to do the tests over time, because that will tell you the direction in which the infection is going. If your percentage positives remain stable, then you know that you haven't got undetected infection circulating in your community. But if they start going up, then you know that you've missed infections through your other methods of surveillance.
So given this much limit on our knowledge of immunity against COVID-19, some of this early talk out of Italy, Europe and elsewhere about, you know, people who are already considered immune, getting immunity cards and being allowed to move and work freely, this is extremely premature, right?
I think it's something we need to be working on right now. What constitutes immunity and how long it lasts is an unknown. But what I would really like to see is people who have been infected coming forward and volunteering to be part of these studies so that we can study the immune response over time. We can look at not just the IgM, IgG, and antibodies that you mentioned earlier, as well as IgA, which is important for mucosal infections, but also look at their functional antibody responses and their cell-mediated immunity. If people who have been infected can volunteer and participate in such studies, that will be hugely helpful in allowing us to think about how to develop an immunity passport. We might find that it is as easy as saying, if you have an easy neutralization test, that is sufficient. We might find that an IgG level above a certain limit might be sufficient. But unless we do more detailed studies, it's going to be very challenging to come up with an immunity passport that is scientifically based and reliable.
So moving on from individual immunity, could you share some thoughts on herd immunity? Again, herd immunity before we have a vaccine, because in some conversations, herd immunity is seen as this inevitable outcome. In some, it is seen as a policy direction or a solution. How do we imagine herd immunity against a disease like this when individual immunity itself is something that we don't know fully about yet?
So herd immunity relies on a proportion of the population being infected in order to stop onward transmission of the infection. So if many of the people that the virus encounters have already been infected before, and they may have short or long-term protection, then they are effectively creating a barrier to the spread of the virus. So as your percentage of people in a population infected goes up, the transmission of the virus decreases. This is almost inevitable for any infectious disease that spreads the way this one does. It's also true for certain other kinds of diseases that spread through the fecal-oral route. But this is common. It happens with most infectious diseases. The problem here is this is a new virus, and therefore the whole world is susceptible. So to get to any level of herd protection or herd immunity, it's going to require a significant proportion of the world to become infected. Different modelers have estimated different rates of infection in the population for delaying or slowing the spread of the virus. And these range from anywhere from, we need 20% of the population to be infected to 60% of the population needing to be infected in order to have herd immunity, as it's called. Those depend on different kinds of mathematical models that have been built, but it doesn't really matter right now where you set that cutoff. The price that we will pay for a lot of rapid infections is going to be very high. And therefore, we need to think at this stage about slowing spread as much as possible, but recognizing that over time, and this may be 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, a significant proportion of the population will become infected.
Even this word herd immunity, while it is a technical term, the word herd implies certain other things as well and sometimes takes us out of our human mores and societal mores. Herd immunity might essentially imply herd culling, where large numbers of people suffer and die in the process. And so it's perhaps not an acceptable price to pay for the eventuality of a herd immunity because of a rapid spread of infection. Dr. Kang, I want to ask one thing. You've given us so much information and insight over these last half an hour or 45 minutes. Could I ask, are there any other big science questions that you think we don't yet have answers to, but we need to get answers to very quickly beyond what we have discussed so far?
We haven't approached the whole area of drugs at all, and trying to understand what kinds of compounds we might have available already that could be utilized to treat infection, I think, is an urgent need. It is being addressed globally, but one thing that is not clear to people is how important it is to have rigorous testing before we decide on a therapy. Whatever that therapy is, we need to hold it to the highest standards of clinical research before we accept it as practice. A lot of doctors, and rightly so, doctors have the freedom for their individual patients to make decisions that are based on their experience and understanding and what they believe to be in that individual patient's best interests. They should do that. They should continue to do that. But if we are to make a treatment policy, then the kind of research that needs to be done is very, very important. It does delay things at a time where everybody wants an instant solution, but the payoff will be in science that we know and can trust.
Thanks, Dr. Kang. So we have to make haste in all directions, but we have to make haste slowly and methodically and systematically. Dr. Kang, thank you so much for joining us on BIC Talks. I can honestly tell you that even having listened to previous talks by you and by others, I think I've walked away with more insight in the last 45 minutes than I have in the last several weeks. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us. The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.